Hello, kids. Fat Segundo here, and I don't understand why some people are obsessed with photography. Yes, it is true that there are a few photographs of me floating around the internet, some of them featuring me with the wholesome actress Vanessa Hudgens, standing in a nude and rather delectable position. But these are blatant manipulations. And besides, Miss Hudgens has failed to return some of my more passionate love letters. Thank goodness our young roving correspondent got to the truth about photographic manipulation with the acclaimed novelist Marianne Wiggins. Wait a minute. Marianne's no longer married to that bald fatwa guy who smiles all the time. She's available, isn't she? Jorge, necesito una pluma. Pronto!
Alright, so I am here with Marianne Wiggins, who is the author of John Dollar, Evidence of Things Unseen, and most recently, The Shadow Catcher. Marianne, how are you doing?
Hi, Ed. I'm very well. How are you?
I'm doing fantastic. First off, I actually wanted to kind of ask you a two-prong question, and that is concerning the sort of the notion of having a Marianne Wiggins narrator in this particular book. The first question I want to ask you is, what is the disparity between, I guess, Marianne Wiggins, the real person, and Marianne Wiggins, the alter ego, who is in this particular book? In your acknowledgments, you thank your sister for the license to decorate our shared history. The other question I wanted to ask, kind of related to this, is do you think that some authors are kind of gravitating towards this fictional sort of alter ego? Like, there's another book, I'm not sure if you're familiar with Catherine Taylor's book.
I'm not.
She has another book out this month called Rules for Saying Goodbye, in which she has a narrator named Catherine Taylor. Sort of makes me wonder whether there's a kind of climate in the air of maybe a post-James Fry kind of thing, where it's not okay to sort of have this kind of subjective truth in a memoir, but it's perfectly okay to have it in fiction. What are your thoughts on these two things?
Well, it goes back, for me personally, it goes back to The Counterlife, Philip Roth's stunning. I mean, when I read that in the 88, 89, I can't remember how long ago, almost 20 years ago, I was stunned. I just thought, how can somebody do that in fiction? But it also goes to Tristram Shandy.
Yeah.
I mean, this is the device has been around a long time. It goes in and out of fashion. James Fry, you mentioned, infuriated me because that was the reverse. That was taking something that should have been, that was touted as being factual, and it turned out to be fictional.
Mm-hmm.
I know what fiction, you know, I know what fiction is made of, and I make no pretense that what I'm telling is a factual memoir. It says a novel on the front of the book, and it's not pretending to be anything else. What the insertion of a character named after myself permitted me to do was to use my conversational vernacular as one of the voices in the book. And then there is another level of language that I use when I write the Edward Curtis historical parts, which is a more formal and elevated prose. When my editor and I were talking about this book, she would refer to the smart Marianne, which is the Marianne that was writing in that elevated prose, which is, I think, the kind of voice that most of my readers are used to.
Mm-hmm.
And then the vernacular Marianne. The Marianne in the book is very much like the Marianne in real life. I'm subject to embarrassing myself. So I take long road trips. I visit Indian reservations. I start sit-down conversations with strangers. I go to places like Las Vegas and end up eating in my room. You know, I'm not a gambler. So all of that was very truthful to who I am. Hope that answers the question.
No, it does. But I guess I'm wondering if, do you think that some authors are, I guess, gravitating towards playing around with these things because they're not going to be subject to the same scrutiny that, say, James Fry is?
Well, for me, it was sort of time to do this. I mean, I have 9 novels in print now, 2 collections of short stories, and I'm 60. So I think at this point, some readers are rather interested in knowing who is that person behind the curtain, who's, you know, as in The Wizard of Oz, who is she? And Recently, when Kurt Vonnegut died, I bought the new set of interviews with him that have just been released. There are three interviews, the first one in 1978 and the last one in 2008. And you can hear his voice deteriorating because of all the Pall Malls.
Yeah.
It's a very moving CD to own and to listen to. But one thing that he says is that one of the reasons that Hemingway's works never communicated to screen is that Hemingway wasn't there. You know, that presence of the author in the work. And Vonnegut certainly did it. He included himself in his work. So it's, as I said, it's not groundbreaking. I don't think of it as my having written a reaction to James Frey. In fact, the manuscript was already in galleys by when that happened.
Sure.
But for me, it's an appropriate time to start to reveal aspects of my family. There was also an enormous amount of pressure on me in 1992 when I came out of hiding with Salman Rushdie to talk about myself only in those terms.
Mm-hmm.
So the fact that I write something semi-autobiographical in a novel which doesn't have anything to do with that event, to show that I had a life elsewhere, a full and rich and complicated life, is another way of my sort of standing up and saying, this is how I want to be defined, and this is who I am.
And at the same time, you could also, I guess, play around and be self-deprecatory about yourself, too. That's the thing that kind of struck me about all the Marianne sections, because I was like reading this going, oh, this is... I think actually the sort of thing that surprised me was when I started to read the first 100-page cluster, that all of a sudden the formalism actually sort of surprised me, because I was actually surprised, oh, I'm kind of like reading it sort of... I'm downshifting here. I'm surprised. Then all of a sudden, oh, okay, I'm back there. So it's kind of like this added jolt. And I have to ask you, what came first in terms of the Edward Curtis thing?
Was the Curtis.
The Curtis stuff?
The Curtis came first. And it is, and reading this is like swimming in a braided river, because there are these two stories that braid in and out. The Marianne tale, she is a woman in the novel who has written a novel about Edward Curtis. And her novel is called Shadowcatcher, and the novel that the reader is holding in his or her hands is called Shadowcatcher. So there's a series of mirror images being set up as a trick to remind the reader that the photographs that Curtis took were always filtered through a lens, mm-hmm. his lens, his take of American Indians, not telling the truth. So there are a lot of veils that come off in this, but it was Curtis who came first.
Yeah.
I knew I wanted to write about him. And the more that I investigated his life, the more disillusioned I became in him as a person. And the more I realized that he was an absent father for all of the time.
Mm-hmm.
He didn't even see his last child until she was 18 years old.
Mm-hmm.
And I sort of realized that his attitude toward Indians was that of a patriarchy, benign patriarchy, and that writing about patriarchal themes emerged as a major theme through this, and that given that, I should also include writing about my father, who disappeared and was absent in my life.
Yeah.
And so that's what I do, and I use a lot of ephemera. I use a Civil War discharge of my great-grandfather is in here, pictures of my own father, pictures of my mother, and they blend with the pictures that Curtis took of the Indians.
Which is very much a kind of, as you acknowledge, a trick taken from Sebald.
Yeah.
I'm wondering if the Marion Wiggins chapters were kind of a way to sort of insulate yourself from the influence of Sebald, because there's more sort of Sebald-like meditations in the Marion chapters than there are in the actual Curtis Clara chapters.
That's probably dictated by language, because there was one thing that I wanted to be diligent about in the Edward S. Curtis chapters was to not write an anachronism, and much of his work was in the late 18th century, early 19th century. Sebald, I think, tends to be post-Freudian.
Yeah.
And so I didn't want to commit an error of time in that way. I also realized in the modern chapters, one of the reasons that I stayed with my instinct to include some modernity was that had I not done so, I wouldn't be able to write about where photography has gone since Curtis.
Mm-hmm.
And then I wouldn't have been able to access references, stated or not, but access references to Ansel Adams and you know, Robert Frank, Dorothea Lange. I mean, I wanted to get beyond the years. Curtis died in 1952, so I wanted to get beyond that.
And yet you take Curtis's story up to roughly around 1900. So there's this kind of buffer between the 21st and the 19th century. I was wondering if this was...
It's not really a biography in any way of Curtis. It is about this... It focuses on the time that he... Well, I can't say he fell in love, but certainly the woman who fell in love with him and ultimately married him, Clara, it is her love story for him.
I was curious, in terms of the research you did, you acknowledge 5 source texts in the acknowledgments.
Yes.
I was wondering, were there many details of Clara that were actually out there in these other texts?
No, hard to find.
I got the sense that you had to really sort of invent from very...
I couldn't find her for the better part of a year. I couldn't find where she was buried.
Wow.
And having read the book, you know that tracing burial points is one of the themes in this book, because I found where Curtis is buried. He's buried in California. And there's a photograph that I took of his gravesite. And I write about the shock of visiting that gravesite. And he's actually buried with his children, whom he had abandoned in life. And it was as if they had decided, we're going to get you finally, Dad. We're going to go to eternity. Mm-hmm. So, you know, surrounding you, so you're not going to get away again. But Clara, I couldn't find. I just was desperate. And then I finally discovered that she had drowned in a boating accident in Puget Sound.
Yeah.
That's the most that I could discover. And that also that she never had a brother. I have a brother in the book. And I write about her parents. I make her father an oil painter so that I can access paintings by Giotto and compare them to the lighting and the modeling that Curtis uses in his own photographs. That's completely made up, Ed. I have no clue who her parents were or what they did. I do know she had 2 sisters, and that's it. That's all. I mean, I know when she died and how she died, but that's about it.
Did you find this to be somewhat of an advantage in the fact that you got a chance to sort of create?
Well, I found it to reinforce my long-known, regretful knowledge that women disappear from history.
Yeah.
In the way that American Indian tales had disappeared from history. So I thought it would complicate the book and make it that more texturally rich to tell it from her point of view, because you're not expecting that. The reader is not expecting that. And also to see Curtis only through her eyes, in the way that Curtis looked at Indians only through his lens. So there's a richness there, I hope, for the reader.
I wanted to actually sort of talk about you allude to the great sort of line from The Man Who Shot Liberty Valance, when the legend becomes fact, print the legend, or when the fact becomes...
Yeah.
What is it exactly? Oh, yeah, when the legend becomes fact, print the legend. I got it right. And I wanted to actually ask you about this, because this kind of, I suppose, dichotomy you have between sort of what is truth and what is legend reminds me very much of Evidence of Things Unseen, where you have a situation there where it's faith versus science. Do you need to have a kind of sort of dualism in place with which to kind of, I guess, puncture holes into these absolutes? Because I saw it in both of your last 2 books.
Well, I think that tension, that, you know, where tension exists, there's great fiction. Even just... And my choice of where I like to... I mean, I love going to Barcelona, for example, because you have the Catalan language rubbing up against the Spanish.
Mm-hmm.
In places in Belgium, which is generally construed to be the most boring country on the planet. It ain't. You got Walloons, you got French, you've got this cultural mix of one rubbing up against the other, and, you know, it creates an energy in which the fiction can thrive.
In terms of photography, I noticed that there were a lot of aspects that carried over from Evidence of Things Unseen. For example, you have the Mrs. Gallagher in the previous book, who's basically pointing to the fact that this African-American has been rubbed out of the photograph. And you allude to the similar sort of notion here in this book, with the clocks being sort of rubbed out. And I'm wondering if this book was, in a certain sense, a way for you to return to themes that you had explored, or was it a way to kind of recontextualize this with a new kind of thematic sort
I think of it's, I think, you know, photography is one of my themes. I mean, it's one of my many themes, but it's, and there's a parallel between writing and reading fiction with looking at photographs. Photographs stop time.
Yeah.
They literally stop time. It's that frozen moment. And when you're reading, you are in an alternative temporal mode. Time slows down or time speeds up, but it's an alternative clock that's ticking. You sort of leave the normal temporal reality. I clearly do when I'm writing. I sometimes lose whole hours. I look up and it's suddenly the afternoon and I started in the morning. And so I'm very comfortable in writing about photography, and I'm fascinated by photographers' lives. So it's clearly this is something that I'm going to go on doing. The new book that I'm writing now has Ansel Adams and Dorothea Lange as characters. So I've found my stage.
My question, though, I have another sort of question related to this, and that is whether things being rubbed out of photographs, it's very much applicable to what Photoshop now does for all of these photos. There was that Hezbollah photo from last year where they were people who were framed as dead, and it was uncovered by the New York Times.
I'm scared to death of this. I'm hoping that with the new technology, we will also be bringing people's sophistication up as quickly as we are making that new technology so that people will be able to see a fakeness. I mean, I think of a recent Vanity Fair photograph, Vanity Fair cover, the green issue, had, what is that young man's name who was in Titanic?
Leonardo DiCaprio.
Yeah. Leonardo DiCaprio is standing on an ice floe with a penguin on either side of him. It was photoshopped. He was clearly not on the ice floe. And you could tell it because he had that odd levitation that occurs when a pediment has been put under the feet and that doesn't quite connect. I actually talked to my students about this, and I said, "What do you think? Is this the real stuff, or is this?" And they said, "No, that's been photoshopped. We can tell."
Yeah.
Hooray! I say, because when you get something burned out of an image, and I'm thinking of what the Russians used to do. Then they burned not Khrushchev out of an image, but some other lackey who was supposed to be standing next to him at a May Day parade, and the guy had clearly not been a true Stalinist, and they just airbrushed him out of the photo as if he hadn't, been associated with the government then. And I was, particularly in the way that we looked at pictures of Abu Ghraib, which those photographs scared the hell out of me. They were deeply disturbing. And nevertheless, something didn't quite click in the American consciousness as though we weren't really looking at the photograph. We've seen so many visual images that our eyes are really not taking in the content of what's in the frame. And so I hope that I'm able to raise that consciousness a little bit in my novels about photography.
Does fiction, I suppose, that dwells upon like the late 19th and early 20th century, that deals and sort of reflects this kind of ongoing dilemma, so we see that, the technology has shifted, but the actual questions are still the same. Is this really, I guess, the way to provoke debate upon this subject?
Or? I hope so. I mean, I think that's what novels do, and I think that's what novels are going to start to do. You and I were talking before we started a tape about Cormac McCarthy's The Road. Yeah. I mean, this is an issue that there should be a 60-minute segment on an impending apocalypse.
Yeah.
Novels are going to start to bring news to readers because news is failing to do that.
And news also can, I suppose, be fabricated too.
Yes,
you know?
I think that's...
I mean, you read an Onion News headline and then like 2 years later it actually becomes fact.
Uh-oh.
I know. I wanted to actually ask you about novels as reference points for you. For example, John Dollar, as many have sort of attested, is kind of a response in this, to a certain degree, of Lord of the Flies. This book is likewise, there's a reference, of course, to Huckleberry Finn. Do you need to have, I suppose, a sort of fictive antecedents at your side when you're actually creating a novel or working on a piece of fiction or concocting a narrative?
I can't get rid of them. I can't get rid of this chorus that follows me around, because I keep books that I've read as part of my personality. And I think that's the joy of reading, that they become, you as a reader own that book then, and you've made your own interpretation. I could not, as a 21st century American novelist, write without those antecedents. I did not invent the form.
Mm-hmm.
I have to give credence to that. And in Evidence of Things Unseen, I began each chapter with a quote from Moby Dick, as a way of sort of saying, thank you, Herman, because I couldn't have done this without you. Not that I'm following a direct lineage back to Melville, but I'm grateful to what I learned reading Moby Dick. I'm grateful for Twain. I'm grateful for most of the books that I read. And we are, I mean, there, We are a family of literature, not a single voice. And I need to keep putting the tent poles up for that big tent in what I write.
Do you think that contemporary literature does a poor job of, I guess, referring or reflecting or acknowledging its antecedents? Or
a writer doesn't have to be as, you know, blatant as I am, of actually saying, well, here's the story about Huckleberry Finn and see how this compares to what I'm writing. It's temperamental. You know, every writer approaches it differently, and some are more generous than others.
I wanted to actually ask you about Edward Curtis. He reminded me very much of Thomas Sutpin in Absalom, Absalom, because he has the same kind of impassive, very sort of rugged...
Remind me again, what was Faulkner's time frame?
Actually, roughly around the same time.
Around the same
time.
Yeah,
Civil War, just a little bit later, yeah.
No, but Curtis is post-Civil War. He was born in 1868.
Yeah, Curtis is
a certain time, I mean... That whole era of Roosevelt, who was a friend of Curtis's, who was a supporter of Curtis's, exemplified the absent man. Men were not expected to involve themselves in domestic mess. And that was what women did, or you had a servant, or somebody, you know, did something. It was a very class structured in that way.
It reminded me also because you have Sutpin sort of using African-Americans to his advantage to create an empire, Curtis likewise is doing the same thing with Native Americans.
He did. He would be shocked that we are saying that.
Yeah.
But he exploited their torment
for
his own personal gain. Or I should say, because he really, in the end, did not profit from any of this. But he exploited them for his own ends. Most every Curtis photograph that you look at, in the way that when you look at a Mapplethorpe photograph, for example, it's only about Robert Mapplethorpe. Mm-hmm. And Curtis's photographs are really only about Curtis. Once you have the sophistication to deconstruct what they really are saying.
Yeah. Well, you point out early in the book that you have the scene with Marion in the book where she's talking to these Hollywood people, and she's explaining to them, no, this is actually not in the 19th century. These were actually taken in the 20th century. It's almost as if you're again, pointing out in the book this kind of, I guess, inability to carbon test in one's mind exactly when these photos are actually taken.
I wish we could. That's a very good analogy to use, carbon testing. But, I mean, he basically was photographing a past that had never existed.
Mm-hmm.
Which is lying. I mean, it's not the same thing. As I said, my book says right on the front, a novel.
Yeah.
So there's no...
well, that's a tough
question. No lying to the... You know, there's no lying to the reader. You basically... I'm stating, warning by the Surgeon General on the front of this book, this is fiction. This is made up. I'm not pretending that this is fact.
Yeah.
Whereas he didn't say any of that. He basically said, this is the way Indians are living today, and it wasn't true.
And in fact, at the very beginning of this book, you were very clear, there's a disclaimer at the very beginning. I noticed that was in almost like, you know, fairly large type, or at least language that sort of basically told the reader, do not rely upon this book as fact. I found that to be quite interesting.
That's basically put in there because I don't want the Curtis family to sue me. But it wasn't really addressed. And it wasn't, I didn't want, you know, the publishers were covering them, you know, covering the spores there. They just didn't want Curtis to rise up from his grave in Forest Lawn in Glendale and come after me, you know, like
John Wiggins,
like Dickens's ghost or something and say, this wasn't true.
Wow. I actually want to talk to you. You were describing at the very beginning of this interview about like wanting to use modern dialogue, your vernacular, in the Marion chapters. And I wanted to actually ask you about just your dialogue in general. I'm really fascinated with its semiotics because you have dashes and italics. And I'm wondering if you could sort of talk to me about how this kind of evolved over the course of the years. And, you know, some books you sort of drop the quotes, some books it's there. So what rules do you set down for each particular book?
I think that probably happens because I don't write at a computer.
Mm.
I write longhand in notebooks. And somehow there's a very central relationship between my pen nib and the page. And so I tend to respect my first impulse and to not go back and make corrections on whether or not to use quotes in dialogue or dashes. And I also find that one interviewer said to me that he thought that I wrote in the equivalent of jazz improvisation. And fortunately, given the luxuriant elasticity of the of the English language and our grammar, you can make all these elliptical riffs. You can put a dash and a parenthesis in and keep the whole thought going seamlessly. I hope the reader doesn't get lost midway through the sentence and say, where is this going and what is this about? But my mind moves in that with that rapidity. So it's almost a musician's notation more than a grammarian's.
Well, specifically, too, the M dash you use is quite long in these books. I was wondering how you actually came across this particular M dash. I guess, did you talk with the publishers over the years and just say, look, it needs to be a really sort of...
Because they would make it short, and then I'd have to... Yes.
Because it just wouldn't be the same, you know?
It has to be a long dash.
Yeah. Okay.
A short dash.
Well, how did the long dash come about? When did you know, like, what...
Well, because I'm writing it longhand, I draw it long. Mm-hmm. So I just needed something typographically that equaled, it has to be, you know, that long. I mean, there's long discussions between me and the copywriters. And,
oh, yeah. Gotcha.
I mean, the copy editors, sorry.
I wanted to actually ask you, I mean, you were alluding, of course, you've moved recently to Los Angeles a couple of years ago, and I was wondering if this actually kind of helped you in relation to writing The Shadow Catcher, because there's a lot of, I guess, concentration upon the, you know, Western California.
Yeah, it's 16 years in England, and I never set a novel there. I set parts of one novel there, but there was nothing about the landscape that I felt that I owned. Mm-hmm. There was also just the, you know, talk about having ghosts follow you around. I mean, why, how could I don't know how this whole batch of wonderful English writers do it. They have to recreate their city. For me, as an outsider, there was nothing about London that inspired me to write. It's a great place to live, to read, and to listen to the language, but I didn't write about the city. Moving to California, I was just up against geology and realized I was inspired by the landscape and by the West. I'm not a Western girl. I'm from Lancaster, Pennsylvania. And I was completely won over by it in the same way that I believe Curtis must have been. So I write, I wax long on landscape in this book.
It's interesting because Clara sort of makes this journey, you know, with
across.
Her brother across the train, very similar to your own particular journey in a certain way. I'm wondering if England was, in a certain sense, I guess, constraining to this vernacular you were describing. You're talking about your own vernacular, but also just, you know, in your books in general, it must have been very difficult to get the sort of, you know, the language absolutely right of these various characters. Particularly, regional sort of...
Well, I couldn't write English. I mean, look, if you have the opportunity to live in England, jump at it. For one thing, there's radio, there's discussion, there's politics. There are, you know, 7 newspapers in one town. I live in a city now, Los Angeles, that has 1 daily newspaper, and even that is struggling for its existence. New York, thank goodness, you've got newspapers here. You've got radio, you've got talk radio, where you can listen to the language, you can listen to different, you know, forms of vernacular. I think, you know, any place that you can live where language is surrounding you it's good for whatever it is that you're doing in your life, but it's particularly good for writing.
Mm. Gotcha. But I mean, in terms of, like, do you actually, like, you know, listening to various people, I mean, in terms to get a vernacular? You mentioned radio and newspapers, but what of actual sort of observation, or is this not something you do so much?
My mother was from the South. Yeah. My mother was from Virginia, so I spent all of the summers of my youth in the American South, which is why I think I could convincingly write Tennessee voices in Evidence of Things Unseen. I mean, no one has written to me and saying, you got it wrong. Yeah. They just, so that, and we have, you know, we listen to one another talk. But I don't necessarily, in Los Angeles, I can't do what I did in England, which was to ride the bus and listen. I'm isolated in Los Angeles in my car or in my house. And so the choice on how to arrive at vernacular and how people speak, I have to say I basically make it up.
Mm, interesting. So many things to ask you. Oh, yeah, actually, I wanted to ask you, in the Marianne chapters, there are moments in early on and actually recurrently throughout the text where you capitalize certain character names, and it almost resembles a sort of Hollywood treatment.
Yeah.
I'm wondering how that kind of came about.
In between... Evidence of Things Unseen and The Shadow Catcher, I wrote 3 screenplays.
Ah.
And And so a little bit of that detritus was left over. Mm-hmm. And I did it purposely to, I think I specifically do it in the scene where she's talking to a Hollywood producer.
Yeah.
And I give the names of those producers in a sort of final draft typography, mm-hmm. as a visual and linguistic joke.
So you really had a lot of meetings with a lot of these Hollywood people.
I had that meeting.
Yeah.
And I was that late, and my hair was that messed up, and I was that covered in perspiration, and it was that funny.
That's great. I actually want to talk to you about, we were talking about patriarchal history earlier, and there's one section in the book where you're comparing Curtis to Teddy Roosevelt over who is the kind of greater avuncular figure. It's interesting to me that in the present sort of day, we're looking back at history, and we have this kind of, I guess, who's the greater patriarch, whereas in the past, in this book, we're actually like dwelling upon, like, well, hey, what happened to Clara? Here's this person who lived and thrived and who was trying to struggle to sort of, you know, find herself after, like, traveling across the country, after abandoning this nursing home education and all that. This seemed to me a kind of interesting kind of a contrast, and I'm wondering if we were talking earlier about the 20th century sort of being this kind of great chasm of which we don't actually see except through these two narratives on one side of the other. In terms of patriarchy and... I'm getting lost in my question.
Invisibility.
Here. Yeah.
I think we tend to see, when we're looking in the past... Look, what are you going to see? You can only see... I look at the cover of this book. It's a picture of mountains. Nevertheless, there's a very interesting foreground of a meadow. When we look at the past, we're only looking at the peaks. And what I have attempted to do is to raise the consciousness of the reader that there's a hell of a lot more out there than just, you know, the apexes.
Yeah.
More than just the Teddy Roosevelt and J.P. Morgan. There are all of these unforgotten, unsung histories. That, you know, whose songs were unlike any other, and they're gone and they're lost. And actually, the book ends on a note of evocation of that kind of music, which I hope is a beautiful note. Which is that, you know, we must almost raise the dead to give us a sense of security about the meaning of what would might seem in our insignificant lives.
Well, the other interesting thing is you actually kind of, the pace of the past chapters are done in this very sort of meticulous, measured, you know, kind of manner until we actually get to the Seattle fire, and then things just go boom. You just start to move forward, and I'm wondering why this kind of, I guess, conflagration Curtis meeting the scientists on Mount Rainier, why this was the point for you that you decided to kind of, I guess, almost fast forward through the narrative.
It may be a fault in my pacing. Mm-hmm. That's for one thing, because, you know, look, I'm not saying everything I write is perfect. I think also what I noticed looking back on that, I think that there was, at the time that I was writing it, I needed more stamina. Because to write measured prose is far more exhausting than to telegraph information in that way, as you can well imagine.
Yeah.
And also, I had more or less reached that point in the Curtis narrative that I tell, where he became a public person, and I was no longer interested in that story because that's on record. And so it becomes a sort of listing of the accomplishments of what happens. Until the denouement, until they have one more encounter with one another, which is their, you know, their last encounter.
So for you, I guess having, I guess, concrete details is almost kind of a stumbling block in terms of conveying a narrative, because then the invention sort of stops, and I guess you're up against what the record has to say.
Yeah, I mean, I wanted to stay true that these two people that I followed their love story in quite excruciating, you know, really
yeah.
detailed, you know, glances and first touches. I mean, very, very small minutiae. Of what develops between them, and then it does become hurried up as soon as he becomes a public person, because, you know, they had reached the point where she filed for divorce. She issued the papers on him in a train station, which I found also evocative, because trains play a major part in this story. there's court records, and their divorce was written about in the Seattle paper at the time, that he was just sat in the front row, a completely broken man.
Wow.
And so his own life went downhill from the point that Morgan cut off his money.
Yeah.
Morgan cut off his money and his wife divorced him. And he became quite a broken person and disappears. The speculation is that he probably had a nervous breakdown and was hospitalized. And then he went off and searched for gold in Nevada. I mean, really bizarre sort of things. And it wasn't serving the story anymore.
Yeah.
And so that's why it's treated in that manner.
There's also, in terms of, like, you know, him pursuing the open road, you have a couple of references to gonzo journalism, Hunter S. Thompson.
Yeah, well, you can't write about Vegas without including Hunter.
Yeah, that's very true. But I guess it almost strikes me, we were talking earlier about, I guess, antecedents, and it seems to me that some of the antecedents you want to include, because we have this chasm of the 20th century, are some of this kind of, putting this kind of galvanizing force into journalism through, you know, Hunter S. Thompson, Thomas Wolfe, and the like.
Yeah.
Excuse me.
Okay.
Sorry. So I'm wondering, was this kind of an effort to, I guess, like, you know, make sure that there were references throughout to, you know, the 20th century, you know, that they could actually link these two narratives together?
Probably. It's hard to say, you know, it's a vacuuming process, and then you have to pick through what's in the vacuum bag. You know, you sort of... you never know when you're building, when you're weaving a tapestry of a novel, you know, what to include, what to exclude, and primarily it's a matter of erring on the exclusion side. Mm-hmm. Try to exclude more than try to include more. But nevertheless, I had to include certain markers so that Vegas would feel real.
Yeah.
Because it's a tough place to write about in any kind of new way.
Yeah.
I have a 4 o'clock.
Last question. I was actually going to wrap it up. Okay. Sorry. I wanted to actually ask you one last question, and that is, was there an actual tub, a glorified sort of tub that Clara had?
Mm.
That's
a complete invention. And it is a plot point, so I don't want to give too much away.
Yeah.
But as I mentioned, when I discovered that she had drowned, which was so bizarre, because she would never go row. I mean, she would never go out on a boat.
Yeah.
She wasn't sporty, and she wasn't, she went on several excursions with Curtis and moaned and really hated it.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was odd that she would have drowned in a rowboat by herself. And that worked as a kernel inside my shell for about a month. I really needed to think about that. Why was she there? And if, in fact, it was not an accidental death, then it's something that I wanted to write about, and if in fact that's the way she died, then I needed to make a shadow version of that as well. As I said, the book is filled with shadows.
Yeah.
I'm doubling and doubling all over the place, and so I thought of putting a scene in early where she's in a bathtub outside and surrounded by sheets that she hangs up. Because it mimics, it shadows her end in the boat.
Yes.
And in both instances, she stands up out of the confines.
Yeah.
of the containment. So that we have these, you know, these two shadowed events. It just seemed logical. I mean, that's the way I built it. And I completely made it up. Maybe she had I have no clue. I have no way of knowing, because...
Yeah.
At the end of your life, Ed, is it anybody know if you took a bath? You know, it's not the sort of stuff that gets written down.
There'll be some novelist writing about us in this conversation. Yeah. Marion, I know you got to go. I have plenty of questions, but it was a pleasure chatting with you. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
Absolutely.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That went so fast.
I turned my camera on. I cut my fingers on the way. On the way. The way of slipping away. I turned my feelings on. You made me untouchable for life. Yeah. Yeah.